Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
That, my friends, was the voice of Brian Brown, creator of the Brown Briefly. Every week, we try to live up to Brian's high standards of hosting a discussion of current events laced with empathy, intelligence, humor, and progressive persuasion. Brian's concept of less is more, more or less, always left us wanting more. Hey, let's jump right in with friends, old and new. Introductions, please. Vachon Airport Commissioner, West Texas devotee, former Army intelligence officer, and high altitude advocate, Truman O'Brien. Good morning, Truman.
Good morning. Good morning. I'm multitasking this morning. So trying to get everything done. Yeah.
Fingers on all the buttons, moving the knobs.
On the big red switch. Yeah, for sure.
Awesome. Okay. As long as there's no hook involved, I think I'm good for today.
Yeah.
We also with us today, historian Skipper of the Vachon, president of the Vachon Heritage Museum, and guardian of the galaxy, Bruce Hallman. Hello, Bruce.
Good morning, everyone. It's good to be here. Nice, beautiful, snowy morning. Kind of the snow you like, enough to make it look pretty, but not impossible to drive on the roads. So,
yeah.
That's right. No slipping and sliding allowed at the moment.
Yes.
Hey, another bit more recent high altitude advocate joins us today, Craig Bellis. It's been said, Craig, while learning to fly, that coming down is the hardest thing. What do you think?
Tom Petty knows. I've been in a few situations in my life where I've gotten into a situation where I have no choice. So you got to get out of it only one way. You can't go back. And those terrify me. I got stuck in a cave once of spelunking, and I knew I couldn't just go out the back door. I had to go back out the way I got stuck when I was coming in. And I never went back into a small cave again. That's the thing about flying. When you're up in the air, you really have no choice. You can't just go, okay, we'll move on to something else and play croquet.
I like
right.
that.
You can't do that.
No.
And Truman and I found out the hard way that it's not about how fast you go. It's about how fast you stop. That really makes the difference. So we try to slow our stops down as much as possible.
As much as possible. That's right.
You know, I saw just last week that the human speed record for skiing is something like 154 miles an hour.
Whoa.
And I was thinking about that stopping part.
I saw that myself.
Hey, I'm
just going to say, I saw that myself. And it amazed me. They're getting close to terminal velocity on the ground on skis. I mean, it's just ridiculous. So
nuts.
Totally. All right. Well, hey, let's keep moving along. This week, our special small talk guest is friend and well-known SQIM democracy advocate Karen Hogan, who played a significant role in SQIM's response to their mayor's QAnon advocacy. Welcome, Karen. I'm glad you could join us today.
There's quite a bit of, whoops, am I muted?
No, we hear you now.
No, we're hearing you now.
Okay. And there's quite a bit of snow in SQIM today. I think that they have not yet plowed Happy Valley Road, or they did and it didn't matter.
Wow.
We've had a lot of snow since last night.
The forecast was pretty intimidating.
Yeah.
Yes. So let's see. My voice is that of Kevin Jones, Indivisible Vachon, and Vachon Climate Action Group, who collectively, those two groups, strive to create a livable planet overseen by a government we can all appreciate or at least tolerate. So let's see. Let's dive into how the week has been. And Karen, you did mention the snow in Squim. The weather reports have been sort of atrocious in terms of what's coming your way. So are you weathering the storm? And maybe anything else you'd like to tell us about your last week here on planet Earth?
Well, I actually kind of like it when it snows like this, as long as it doesn't stay too long. I really like the way it transforms the landscape. Mm-hmm. So I really like that an awful lot. And the last week has been kind of, you know, yesterday I went to Costco in anticipation of the snow, along with everybody else at Squim. I thought I was being so clever, but so was everybody else. So, you know, I lived in Oklahoma, Saudi Arabia, and California before moving to Washington. And so snow is a new phenomenon for me.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, and good planning sounds like is part of your agenda.
Truman. After 9 years, I'm starting to learn.
All right. Truman, how has your week been?
Well, I have to comment on that moving to Washington. I moved to Montana from West Texas in January. And in West Texas, I had probably seen snow maybe twice in my whole life, and then no more than about, you know, 2 inches. And my first day of school in Montana was about 3 feet of snow on the ground. It was about 20 below. And I'm thinking, man, this is a horrible place. I couldn't believe it. That was pretty, but man, it was cold. But my week, I had a friend fly me down to Oregon on Wednesday, and we picked up our airplane and flew it back. And got back just a little bit late, actually. It was starting to not get dark, but it was definitely twilight. And that was my first landing back at on Vashon Municipal with the trees and all. And it was interesting, to say the least. But I got back safely, and the airplane's back tucked away in the hangar, so out of the snow.
All right. Well, of course, very welcome that you're here.
Thank you.
Bruce, how's your week been?
Well, it's been a good week. We actually, the last few days, we've set up the electric trains. I have 2 5-year-old and 2 9-year-old grandchildren, and you know they've grown up with computers and electronic toys and, you know, radio controlled sort of devices, but they are fascinated by the old time electric trains that all of us grew up with. And it's just been kind of magical, you know. So we always set up trains around our Christmas tree, and they've always come over. And our son just bought a house in Ellisport. And so for this year, we set up trains at their house as well. Cool. So cool. It's just been exciting. But I'm just amazed, these kids that have grown up with all this high-tech stuff and all this electronic toys and, you know, computers and iPads and all that stuff. They are just fascinated by just old-time mechanical electric trains. It's really interesting.
Bruce, tell them what Parker said. Mm-hmm.
Does it make a Heritage Museum president proud of that?
Oh, it does. Yeah. In fact, one of my grandsons said, when we were setting the trains up, he said, "This is my favorite part of the Christmas holiday."
Oh, cool.
Isn't that touching?
Fantastic. All right. So, Craig, how's your week? Have you been airborne like Truman?
No.
Or you pretty much had feet planted on the ground?
No, I've been earthbound. I tried to get up in the air. My partner in plane and former Alaska Airline pilot graced me with a couple of discount certificates to fly back to Oakland to see my brother and family. But unfortunately, going standby at this time of the year is... Not pretty
iffy at best.
It really is. It was sketchy. So I got over to Fauntleroy and turned around and came back after I found out how many people were ahead of me. So that was the unfortunate part. But I am getting ready for this evening. This evening, Father Christmas is going to be at the Vashon Theater for the 35th annual sing-along. The hardcore carolers from all over the island, whether you can sing or carry a note or not, will be joining us for the free 35th sing-along at the Vashon Theater.
What time?
6 o'clock. Thank you.
All right. Well, if those, if our listeners could only be here with us on Zoom, they'd see you're well prepared with the red and white classic Santa hat.
Yeah. Awesome. In San Francisco, you know how there's the sing-along hallelujah chorus?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They had a dance-along nutcracker.
Oh my goodness. That would have been a sight.
That's San Francisco. I love San Francisco.
Yeah. Nice. Union Square. I miss all of the stores and the toy store there and whatnot.
All right. Well, we, of course, the wonderful traditions here on Vashon Mori Island are also very sustaining. Let's see. Hey, I'll share a little bit about my week. I have the great benefit of some friends decided to join me on a safe snow travel workshop. And there is enough snow up there in the mountains at Snoqualmie Pass to slide around. And so we did that. And we were playing with ice axes and trying not to, you know, impale ourselves. And I will say I was gratified that a good time apparently was had by all. And everybody said they want to go back. So, yeah, we'll keep enjoying this winter weather we have. All right. So, hey, I would like to dive right into small talk. And just to open that up, in some social media corners, we've probably all heard that a former president is still claiming the 2020 presidential election had massive and widespread fraud and deception. That's all capital letters. And suggested the country should throw the presidential election results of 2022 out and declare the rightful winner or have a new election. Not satisfied with that, the former guy goes on to say that a massive fraud of this type and magnitude allows for the termination of all rules, regulations, and articles, even those found in the Constitution. I'm sure you've heard that. Meanwhile, in the real world, there's no evidence of massive election fraud, but the consequences of these and related conspiracies create real concerns in communities like Squim, where in 2020, their town mayor advocated QAnon as a truth movement, which he encouraged his constituents to learn more about. The health of U.S. democracy has been an item of interest leading up to and after last November's elections. So, Karen Hogan, we thank you for joining us on Small Talk today, because we'd like to hear about your thoughts about it takes a village to save democracy in your advocacy regarding your mayor of Squim.
Well, what I mean by that is that it actually, what got the mayor out was cross-partisan. I mean, it was nonpartisan. People did not want to have him as the mayor anymore. He became an embarrassment, not only just because of the QAnon, but a bunch of other things too. I mean, when we had the BLM march here and they had the guy walking with the protesters carrying an AR-15 and a guard dog. The mayor's reaction is basically, well, boys will be boys. So you just sort of have to let them do that. Mm-hmm. So across the board, people wanted decency, I think. I mean, I think that's kind of what happened in the midterm election too.
Absolutely.
It was still too close, in my opinion, you know, but but I think people want decency. I think the fact that these aren't the Republicans I grew up with. This is something entirely different. It's just, unfortunately, it's taken on the mantle of the Republican Party. The fact that the way they reacted to Nancy Pelosi's husband being attacked was just so shameful. Just, and when Steve Scalise was shot, she was right there offering comfort. So it's, I don't know, it's pretty interesting out there.
There is the definite divide of how people think and how people respond to these things. I would like to ask, what prompted you personally, given the situation that the residents of Squim found themselves, but how did you move yourself personally to say, you know, I want to be involved in this? What was your main goal of protecting and strengthening democracy in your town of Squim?
I got involved when there was a really nasty thing that was happening against the tribe who was trying to build the healing clinic, which is the opioid treatment center. And the group was just taking over the public comments during the meetings. And so I just felt like I had to start giving the other side, because there was a lot of misinformation and what I like that somebody coined malinformation that was coming out. And it included a horrible, horrible racist rants against the tribe members. So that's why I got involved. It seemed to me that what the tribe was offering with this healing clinic was state-of-the-art treatment, state-of-the-art medical care, state-of-the-art science. And it just was, it was small-minded and tiny-hearted the way they were coming against it.
And this is now the Jamestown Sklallam tribe, I understand?
Yes, who has a, yes.
Yes. That's their indigenous lands.
They have a family health center, and they also have opened the what they call the healing clinic.
Yeah.
Okay.
Jamestown Sklallam is a really interesting case history, because they have not been a traditionally federally recognized tribe until recently. What it was is a group of natives bought land on the bay there and basically established their own quote-unquote reservation. They would wasn't an official government reservation, but they created their own sort of property, and the tribe has grown out of that. And so it's a very different history than most other tribes that were removed and put on reservations. And it's a very striking example of how Native people can organize themselves and protect their culture and protect their heritage in a fascinating way.
They bought back their land, basically.
Right.
I mean, I just, whenever I hear people complaining about, oh, you know, the tribe's taking over and maybe they're going to want to rename Squim, I mean, that gives me the biggest giggles, because Squim is, of course, their name for Squim. So it's pretty impressive what they do, I think, what the tribe does.
So, Karen, you we know that Squim made headlines regarding the mayor once the QAnon advocacy was revealed. And so you then, let's roll the tape back, right? You find yourself in this situation with this mayor's advocacy of QAnon. How did the community mobilize? What kind of outreach was there? And given all the work that was done and all of that outreach and building relationships and networks, which I'd like to hear about, you know, what's the current situation? What did you do, and where are you now in terms of bringing people together around democracy?
Well, both Indivisible Squim and a group called Squim Good Governance League kept Marsha McGuire and I kept things engaged by speaking during public comments. Marsha McGuire was a librarian at the Library of Congress, and boy, do not mess with librarians. she's a very soft-spoken kind of more of an introvert kind of a person, but boy, you do not want to mess with her. So it also kind of started because the mayor basically, and three people he appointed basically fired a very popular and very, very articulate and very competent city manager. And it seems like, why did they fire him? It seems like some of it had to do with the people who were opposed to the clinic thought that he should have broken the law and not approved it. And it also seems like it had a lot to do with the mayor having his nose out of joint, that Charlie Bush, the city manager, called him out on using his Coffee with the Mayor platform to promote QAnon. And it cost $250,000 for the city to do that. By the time they got rid of him, paid for his, you know, and then got in a new city manager. So, so that sort of started mobilizing people. And then between Indivisible Swim and Swim Good Governance League, we found good candidates to run, which had been a problem the last time. Nobody was running, ran in the previous election. And then a woman named Chris Walker, who was a union organizer, came in and helped do the final, what I call the brought it home by doing the organizing so that we could go door to door and do that feet on the ground thing of talking to people.
Oh, okay. Craig, I think you had a question.
Well, I did. This all seems to be an example of how democracy can work and how democracy can be ugly. I mean, obviously, this individual was elected in the first place. In my former life, when I was the president of the community council, it was all about who showed up and who did the work and who advocated. And it sounds like once everybody mobilized in response to this individual, you're able to bring things back, at least bring things back to the middle, which is the great thing. But it takes people to not sit at home on their couches.
Yeah, he was elected. Okay, so in that election, that was right after the group called Save Our Squim, which was the opposing the clinic, would come in and take over the meetings, and it really created this very hostile environment. I mean, mm-hmm. and city council members were getting threats. So I think that's a part of why hardly anybody ran. Armacost ran unopposed, and he still only got about 1,000 votes.
Wow.
So it was I think that one of the biggest things that happened in this last election is that people realized we can't be asleep at the wheel.
Right.
And in some ways, I feel like city government is kind of like the first step of democracy. Mm-hmm. It's you know, where you know, you have the most impact.
Yep.
And your voices can be the strongest. Yeah. So that was good. I mean, we really were able to get right things back by getting good people on. There was an awful lot of damage that coalition that we called them the what did we call them? I can't remember what
it's not one of the seven words you can't use on the air, is it?
No, it's not.
Although I'm sure that was in private, probably what they were called, right?
Yeah. I had to clean up my language to become a bartender. So.
Yeah, there you go.
The Gang of Four, we called them.
Ah.
And they did a lot of damage. They just, they created a really hostile environment for the city workers, for the city staff. And we're still recovering from it. People are saying, yeah, there needs to be a healing. And in my opinion, if you're going to have a healing, you also have to decide to identify and define what you're healing from. And I think we're having a hard time with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bruce, you have a question.
Yeah, Karen. You know, city governments, county governments are one level of the basic sort of democracy at work. The other is school districts. What was going on with the Squim school district and in terms of this kind of anti-democratic QAnon kind of stuff? Because that's happening all over the place. What did you experience in Squim?
We were able to keep any kind of QAnon types off the Squim school board. There's been a lot of turmoil in the school district, and I do not understand all of what it's about. In fact, I understand very little of what it's about, so I hesitate to speak too much to it. But so far, we've been able to keep the people who are trying to keep kids from learning out of the school, off the school board.
Let me follow up with a question too, because it seems like what you're talking about is coalition building. What Craig talked about is getting the center together, if you will. I mean, what was the process you went through to sort of, I mean, you're pulling together some pretty disparate sort of views from traditional sort of Republicans and traditional, you know, Democrats, and then those on the further to the left, you know, opposing those that are way, way to the right. How do you find candidates? How do you build that coalition?
Well, it's finding the candidates is difficult because it's a commitment and a time commitment, and there can be a lot of hostility towards them. So finding the candidates is tough. You have to be live within the SWIM city limits to be a candidate. So that was kind of tough. But we found them. And we're going to be looking again because William R. McCost is one of the people who's up for re-election this year. Mm-hmm. And then just, again, it was kind of the old fashioned going door to door, talking to people, you know, and finding ways that you can, talk to people. And then that's how you find out that you're not alone in the feeling that, like, in your feeling that there's a decency that needs to be returned to the village, for lack of a better word. So, yeah, that was, you know, it was, you know, shoe leather.
So Karen, in the wake of that outreach, you know, it sounds like you must have talked to quite a few people. Are you finding that's durable, and that you kind of have this now community of people coming together that have this common focus and awareness? Or do you think it's something that sort of is fleeting and you just have to rebuild it every time? What's your sense of community now in SWIM around this issue?
I think one needs to build it again. I mean, for one thing, it's like, how many people listen to the city council meetings, right? And unfortunately, William R. McCost is there doing poison pills to things, fomenting fear. So it's hard. I mean, people are busy, you know, you want people who have families to be engaged, and everybody's kind of overwhelmed, you know? So I don't know how exactly we're going to do it this next time, but we're already starting to gear up to finding candidates to run.
All right. The other thing is that that kind of comes to mind. You mentioned a couple of indicators. You mentioned sort of hateful rhetoric. You mentioned anger that comes up. So I'm kind of thinking in terms of, you know, when things are going well, it seems like, you know, you can kind of, people are comfortable to say, oh, I'll go on autopilot. They're good folks. They'll take care of things. What are the things, in addition to those that you've already mentioned, that you might suggest that people keep an eye on in their local governance to, as an indicator of that there may be underlying problems that they should pay more attention to?
I think primarily it's the whole thing about hate speech and conspiracy theories. I have this theory that because of everything that's happened over the last few years, there's a whole lot of white people that are just completely distressed to find out God doesn't love them best. And I think that's really created an underlying kind of a fear of, we're going to lose something here. We're going to lose our position. Looking out for that, like how people are feeling about, like, are they going to, what's going to, how are people are reacting to the fact that we don't have any choice but to look at diversity now? Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, it does. Truman, you sound like you want to jump in.
Yeah, I just, one of the things that one of my Army buddies said not long ago was, Biden's just given the country away. And I questioned that. I said, well, to whom is he giving the country? And he kind of blew up at that. Like, you know, like, I thought you were smarter than that, you know. And but I think it's getting right at what you're saying, Karen, that not recognizing the diversity or fearing the diversity that
right.
we have.
So. That you're going to lose.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Craig.
And I think that those of us on the left, like, I don't speak for everyone, but those of us on the left have to be careful because we can further the divide and up the resentment by, if you will, looking down or giving people the feeling that they're being looked down on by the elite, by the intelligentsia, by the white collar. I mean, those are things we have to be sensitive to. I mean, there are times you have to fight back, but then there are other times when kindness and love might be the way to go.
Mm-hmm. My only question with that, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Sorry. I was just going to say Hillary Clinton's concept of the deplorables certainly had that kind of yeah. feedback and that kind of pushback right. coming from people who don't feel deplorable, but feel that they're not heard.
Right.
Yeah.
Sorry. My question about that is, how do you speak to Nazis? Because that's, you know, what do you do when it's, I mean, I get it that people are scared, that people are afraid and, you know, so forth and so on. And you can only do so much, I think, with, I don't know how to talk to them when they take it to the extreme. And when they feel like, you know, that they're, I mean, that Biden's giving the country away to who? You know, somebody else is getting more than I am, and how come that's happening? It's, you know, and it's usually not somebody who is any kind of distress, really. You know, they're just kind of afraid of it. Does that make sense, what I'm saying, and like where my question comes in?
Absolutely.
Oh, it is the question. It's very, very difficult. I mean, I have that same knee-jerk reaction. I'm going, are you kidding me? I mean, I can't even talk to these people. But in my business, sometimes I have to talk to these people. And we look for some kinds of common ground. I mean, there typically is common ground, not on those topics, but there is other common ground out there that, I mean, I have a good friend who's in law enforcement, who politically is on the other side of the world from me. but as he says, he'd take a bullet for me. And that common ground is room to get something started in terms of the discussion, to get one another to listen to each other a bit.
Yeah, I have exactly the same issue. I have my army buddies that I keep talking about, and to those guys, I say, you know, we have a lot more in common than we do in difference. One of the main differences we have is Donald Trump, but those guys are total, you know, advocates thereof. And I wanted to share with you an email that I got. I sent an email to these guys, and I just said, you know, I know that we've agreed to disagree about the Donald, but what do you guys think about the January 6th thing? Do you think those guys were justified or should they be prosecuted, or, you know, what do you think about that? And I said, not the hearings, but the actual event. And mm-hmm. what I got back was from one of the guys is, it doesn't look like anybody cares. My 401k has taken a big hit since that day. Gas prices are through the roof. Food prices are sky high. 13 killed in Afghanistan. Billions of weapons left behind. Drugs are flowing and the border is open. So that's enough for now. So rather than deal with, you know, all I got back was the line from...
it's the
from
what about.
Side. Yeah, exactly. I found that very interesting. Yeah.
You know, I used to say this isn't the country that I grew up in. And then when I have a friend who's a descendant from the tribe, and it's like, it actually is the country I grew up in, depending on whether you're a person of color, in some ways being a woman, depending on how much you challenge things. But so the thing about those kind of things that person was talking about, they're happening all the time to people who don't have who feel like they don't have a voice. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I think that all of a sudden some people are finding out they may have to share, and it scares them. I don't mean to be nasty by saying this. I just sort of am trying to figure out. I mean, I have family that from Oklahoma who, back when I went to visit them back in the late 70s, claimed that Karen Silkwood was stealing plutonium for the communists because, you know, the communists can't get it anywhere else. Yeah. But you know, it was also, you know, I also had wonderful lunches and breakfasts with them growing up. And when I was visiting with them, I was just, you know, kind of their little darling. So it's, yeah. you know, you have to find some kind of middle ground. I think you have to find some kind of a meeting place. But where do you not compromise so that the racism and I mean, it has to change. It just has to change. So where do you go where you don't compromise? Where's the line where you're not going to compromise? Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah. You know, and it strikes me that it's more than what you say, more than just what you say. It's what you do. It's yes. who you are, you know. Yeah. I think that makes a difference. And showing that the kindness or the humanity that you have is one way to get there, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah, what I hear is the seeking of common ground. Find it where you can, build on it when you can, but stay true to values and recognize that there's certain places where as an individual, we may, and we're all different. We all have our own value fingerprint, if you will, but right, we're just not okay to go in some directions. And I would hope that that staying to our values basically is a sign of respect for our views. And I would hope that the people we're talking to who have different values, we would at least maybe walk away and say, I respect the fact that you're sticking to your values. Mm-hmm. So to what extent that is helpful, we'll see. But yeah, it's I've experienced these same kinds of conversations, and it's challenging, and I'm glad that people are staying with it.
What I think is interesting is, like, with things like the whole debate about abortion and so forth, is that we're finding that how do you turn that over to the legal? It's like, how do you make something illegal that really has something more to do with somebody's individual choice and health and so on? I mean, it's just, you know, the way that they're coming up with the laws, it just shows that you can't do it. So, I find that interesting, the whole thing about trans kids and so forth. It's going to be really interesting to see how we deal with those kind of things moving forward, particularly with this Congress that we've got in place now.
Well, you know, just a perfect segue, because I did want to go into the fact that, you know, we've been talking about your experience in SQIM over the last several years. We did, of course, the midterm election was just 6 weeks ago now. And the election results, I think, surprised some in terms of what the outcome was versus what their expectation was. We've talked on this show about what the election means and how it basically gives us a bellwether about the state of our democracy in this country. Karen, I'm curious what you take away from the 2020 midterm election. And are you encouraged, or is there still signs of concern that you... I mean, to what extent are there signs of concern that you'd like to share with us? What are your thoughts?
Well, I think that the House is going to be silly. I mean, you know, they're about ready to have revenge hearings and so forth. And I think I'm hoping they shoot themselves in their foot, in their collected feet. mm-hmm. But I don't know how much damage they can cause in the meantime. So I don't know. I mean, it's really curious because it's not the way we thought. We thought we were going to get completely annihilated. And I'm hoping Manchin doesn't switch parties in the Senate. But I think, again, it says something, the way that the election went says something about that. I think the American people want decency. And a whole bunch more people are voting, and I think younger people are voting. I thought I'd be much older before I talked about younger people, but
yeah. don't yes. we all?
You're part of our club.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, I think that you really hit on the. I think the key to the whole thing really is decency. People are just really tired of being trashed and hearing all the you know. Violent rhetoric and blah, blah, blah. Let's just get back to something sensible, you know, and I think that's one of the biggest factors in the, of the, the way the election came out.
Yeah.
Well, it's very interesting. We've also on the show, of course, talked a lot about the state of our country, the state of our democracy, historically, what has happened and how did the country move forward. We've also relied on Bruce very heavily for his perspective on that. And now what we have is yesterday, a day that will be historic, according to many newscasters who I've been listening to carefully over the last 24 hours. With the basically the select committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol have forwarded to the Justice Department a recommendation, a criminal referral for the former president. Bruce, how do you predict that yesterday's referral of Trump to the Department of Justice, how's that going to rank among other events in the history of the U.S. presidency?
Oh, I think, I think it's going to be right up there. It's essentially asking that question, is a president above the law, you know, and is an ex-president above the law, or does an ex-president become a citizen just like everybody else? And what I found interesting about the referrals, and Craig, I'd like to hear your thoughts on this. I mean, essentially, they've it passed on sort of a sense that Trump violated potentially four laws and passed that on to the Justice Department. And so I'm interested whether the Justice Department will pick those up and actually prosecute or take them further. But the first is to obstruct an official proceeding, which was the electoral vote count, a conspiracy to defraud the United States, stealing the election, conspiracy to make false statements, basically the false elector scheme, and this is to me probably the most interesting, that he incited, assisted, or provided aid and comfort to an insurrection, plus, you know, additional potential charges of obstruction of justice, you know, and then the whole documents kind of thing that's going on. So there's a set of five or six cases, each one of which could be taken to prosecution, and any one of them, which particularly the assisting and aiding and comfort and insurrection, would make Trump ineligible to run for office again. Craig, what do you think? Are those adjudicated kind of cases? Will they go to court, do you think?
I think they'll go to court, most of them at least. The Department of Justice does walk a bit of a political optics line. I'm sure they're a little schizoid about this whole issue. They've got a lot of evidence because the committee engaged in a lot more interviews than they have. So they have lots of good evidence and lots of good leads and whatnot that they'll get out of it, but they don't want to, and Garland has really been, very careful about this. He doesn't want to be accused of being political. One of the reasons why he picked a special counsel for this, but they will use this information I went on record about 6 or more months ago saying the ex-president will be prosecuted for a number of crimes. Whether he spends time in an orange set of pajamas is another question.
I have a question, though, for you, Craig. So all of the material that the committee produced, is that material admissible in court, or does it have to come from the grand jury? I mean, can they use that data?
It's admissible in court if it's admissible in court. It's admissible in court if it's admissible under the rules of evidence. A lot of the things that are in there are hearsay, and there are lots of exceptions to the hearsay rule. But anything that could be potentially, and then there's also a question of the best evidence. A lot of these things that are written down that were sworn testimony, if I was on the other side, I'd say, no, you got to get the person in there.
Right.
They've got to be in court, and the jury has to see what they say and how they say it.
Well, I mean, I was thinking particularly of the young woman, with Hutcherson, or the one who's the aide.
The one that had the real blockbuster.
But a lot of her stuff was hearsay, and that's what I was wondering. I mean, she had some stuff that she directly heard or saw, which would, I think, would be directly admissible, but the other was just that.
Well, know? And the other issue there is the Department of Justice has tools that the legislature did not. Congress did not. They can force people to testify, force people to come in for interviews and stuff. That, whereas we found out there are four major individuals who just ignored the subpoenas from Congress.
And those have to be then referred to the Justice Department for prosecution, right? I mean, they don't have any.
No, they don't have the ability. They did refer those, is my understanding, to the Ethics Committee.
Right.
Because disregarding congressional subpoenas is not something that typically has been done in the past.
Right.
So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, Karen, one area I'd like to get your thoughts, but I'd like to maybe also frame the question as well. You know, you mentioned the fear and the hate speech. What we've seen is now some of those who were on the Capitol grounds have now been found guilty of seditious conspiracy. Those were also some of the same people who brought forward conspiracy theories. They brought weapons. They brought violence into the situation. Now what we have is this referral of not only the president, former president, but also many others to be held to account. I'm curious if, what did you hear from the proceedings of the committee? I assume you listened to the proceedings.
Oh, yeah,
what's your sense of the steps they're taking? And do you think that might have a pushback on this raising of fear? Or if, in general, what else did you maybe like to share with us about your thoughts?
I guess my main fear is that the incoming House of Representatives, the leadership, is going to keep promoting that kind of a fear. I didn't mean that to sound quite so snarky as I did about, you know, white people finding out God doesn't love them best. I actually think that's a place for compassion, because it's really scary when your universe gets upended like that. Somebody asked Joseph Campbell, does the way that people create their myths and stories, is it related to where they live? And he said yes, and he used an example of a pygmy who was used to a canopied environment and then went up to the top of a mountain and was completely freaked out to see how wide the world is, how different it is. And I think we're all sort of those pygmies up at that top of that mountain right now, trying to figure out, what do we do with this world that we see that's that encompasses so much ambiguity and everybody's right.
Yeah.
You know, in their own for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yes.
So I don't know. I mean, I remember the weekend before the election, I woke up just in an absolute panic, because I thought, I have no idea what I'm going to do if it goes the wrong way. It was much encouraging with what happened with it, but I think we're not out of the woods yet. That's what I think.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So Bruce, let me go back to you, because we've talked about the former guy and where he is on the presidential rankings. And this is, if you want to look this up online, historians will be asked about their views of where the presidents should be ranked in terms of their value to the country. Abraham Lincoln, you know, is really up there towards the top. George Washington, Jefferson, you'd expect that. The former president is about the fourth or fifth from the bottom, but not at the bottom. So, Bruce, what's your prediction? If the former president's convicted of trying to overthrow the government in which he was in charge, do you think that's a certainty that that'll place him on the bottom of the list? Or is it going to take more than that?
I think he's headed there.
Okay. You know,
it's because the guy on the bottom, Buchanan, is sort of in the 1850s, you know, did nothing and actually exacerbated the events that led to the Civil War. And his inaction is why he is usually ranked as sort of the worst president. My sense is what Trump is confronting as a ranked as a president is the fact that he actually tried to destroy the office and destroy the democracy that creates the office. And so I think as this sort of develops and as we get more perspective on it and as the court cases and the orange jumpsuits come out, you're going to see him plummet in that ranking.
It's not far to fall.
he's close.
I mean, plummet probably is a more of a term that you would need in that case. But.
He won't have a treetop landing.
No.
To me, the thing with Trump, it's kind of the same thing that I feel about Armacost, is that they're kind of loathsome people. And I don't say that lightly. I think they don't have any kind of a sense of responsibility to other human beings. They're just kind of they're kind of always in survival mode and ready to attack. And that's and then the way they treat people. So I have no problem with thinking of him as loathsome. It's not even a political thing, you know. It's just goes back to decency.
Well, and Karen, I understand you've been like across the dais from Armacost. They're the QAnon mayor of Squim, raising issues and feeling the return of inviction when you've done so, if I understand right.
Yeah, he accused me of lying during a public meeting about he had encouraged his supporters to go to the home of Dr. Barry late at night. After she received death threats, and he said it was a bald-faced lie, but there's a video to show it. I think part of the problem right now is that what do you do when somebody on the city council is doing that kind of attack to a citizen, because that discourages participation, and when there's like malinformation and misinformation that he's doing. That's hard to do. I think they're struggling with our city council trying to figure out what do you do with that.
It sounds like that's another important watchword for people who interact with our local governments is not only the hate speech and misinformation, disinformation, but how are people treated? And is intimidation part of the plan? It's sort of, I would conclude that if intimidation is part of the agenda, that you should get a pretty quick idea something's wrong.
I have a real question, and Craig, sort of for you. I mean, Vashon doesn't have a government, you know, in the sense that we don't elect, we have a school board, but we don't have a government in that sense. You know, we're under King County, we're unincorporated, that kind of thing. You know, how do you deal when you don't have that kind of public forum? We have the community council, we have organizations on the island, but we don't have a real place where that kind of confrontation takes place on Vashon. Craig, what's your read on that? How do we get to a place where Squim is, where sort of a coalition comes together, of a coalition of decency, if you will?
Well, we do have the resurgence of the community council, and government or no government. I mean, when we studied this 30 years ago, there were many issues that militated against having a real government on Vashon, because there were we found that we could accomplish almost everything we needed by speaking through a representative voice, and it was a matter of boots on the ground. As was referenced here a while ago, I don't know how many people showed up for those Squim meetings, probably a few after they became contentious, But, you know, our community council here, which now meets basically by Zoom, my guess would be we always have more people attending that than King County's meetings have. It doesn't take a lot of people speaking with one voice to move the powers that be. So coming together in some form, the community council, I think, is an excellent way of doing it. There are others, you know, through all of our various nonprofits to speak, you know, the ones that Kevin are involved in, of course, and whatnot. So
you know, the one thing that that Karen mentioned earlier was the poison pill. And, you know, we had, when the original community council, the one before this one anyway, was basically destroyed by what person? And that poison pill that killed the whole thing. And I'm wondering, how do we defend against that? What do we do to keep that kind of thing from happening?
That's a really difficult question, because what you've got is you've got volunteers, first of all, you know, they've got better things to do than to resist lawsuits and and requests for documents and to turn over all their emails, which is what, in fact, happened to the last organized community council. And they go, in a cost-benefit analysis, I don't. So that litigation... and some might say abuse of litigation is horribly destructive.
But of course, when you have a city council like Squim does, that's an elected group of citizens. I mean, people are really still volunteers, even though they're elected officials. So, you know, does that work there as well? I mean, I would assume that it would.
I think you've got the same issues.
Yeah. Okay.
But you know, I mean, that's nothing really. I think you've got people that are committed that are on the council now.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. Before we're down to our last few minutes. Before we do shove off, I wanted to bring up something that caught my attention a while back. That how Donald Trump appeals to men who are secretly insecure about their manhood. And the lead on that article says that Trump appears to appeal more to men who are secretly insecure about their manhood. We call this the fragile masculinity hypothesis. And they go on to present some of their evidence about we know how bombastic Trump is. And presumably insecure men are willing to align with that to help improve their self-image, I suspect. What do we all think about that? Maybe Karen, you might want to you want to hazard any comments about that?
Well, I think it's interesting that women don't feel insecure about their womanhood, or that doesn't seem to be an issue. So I think that speaks to the fact that there's a sea change where just being a man in the past, you didn't have to do much, but you could get ahead, men like my husband and like you gentlemen here, we're not like that, right? So I think it's curious, what is it about manhood that makes it so prone to insecurity? Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, how do you prove that you're a man? What's that about?
Yeah.
Even Craig.
Evolution. There's a question of how far we've sprung. And we all like to think we have sprung all the way, and we haven't come anywhere close to that. But I want to thank you, Kevin, for that question. I read that article. That bringing this topic up is going to do a lot to bring the tribes back together.
Okay. Well, I did want to sort of leave on a potentially humorous note. I don't know, Bruce, you mentioned the French and their relationship with barbecuing. I don't know if you wanted to comment on this particular item or not.
Well, I think the Trump playing cards is sort of all you need to know.
Oh, God.
That comes.
That is just...
Okay. Well... Well, I'm wondering now whether there's some battleground district Democratic campaign strategist who's calculating how many 4x4 pickup trucks they could donate to male voters in their districts to swing their election. But I won't go there.
Right?
I will say that upcoming on the Brown Briefing next week, we hear from Small Talk guests Bill Moyer, Tom White, Dr. Breck Lebigu about how rail transportation can address the climate crisis. So for us this week, Karen, thank you for joining us. For Bruce,
thank you for having me.
Craig, I'm Kevin Jones. Hope you'll join us next Tuesday for the next edition of the Brown Briefly.
And everybody have lovely holidays.
You too.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thanks. Have a wonderful week.